This is the Six Gun Justice Podcast with Wordslingers Paul Bishop and Richard Frosch.
Howdy, it's good to have you join us for another action-packed episode of the Six Gun Justice Podcast, where we celebrate the blazing six-gun action of the Western genre in books, movies, TV, and any other media at home on the range. I'm Paul Bishop, and saddling up next to me is my co-host Richard Frosch. Howdy, pal. Are you keeping your powder dry?
I'm trying. It's kind of tough with all the spring showers out here on the prairie.
You should move to Southern California, and we never think about the weather here.
You don't think about much else either.
There's your rim shot. Congratulations. And before you get too big for those narrow-toed Cuban-heeled cowboy boots, why don't you tell our listeners about today's episode?
The dusty winding trails of cattle drives and wagon trains have always been a mainstay of the Western genre. Today we're going to explore some of those dusty trails in the books, TV shows, and movies that followed them.
Can I bring my GPS?
Absolutely not. I don't know why I put up with you, you know?
Maybe because I can follow hoof prints in the dark and can tell from the smell and consistency of road apples how close we're getting to the owl hoot we're after.
Yuck. I'll take your word for it, okay?
But as usual, before we get to the main feature, we've got a couple of reviews to share. I know you've been looking at a very different style of Western comic.
I have, and it's really been quite the ride. While my appetite for prose is satiated by an equal combination of electronic and paper, nearly all my comic book reads are digital these days. Marvel and DC Comics both have decent apps for purchasing and viewing comics on a tablet or phone, and Comixology catches most of the other independent output. The trouble is, even with the eternal death cries of the comic book industry, there is still more stuff than I have time to read, and let's be honest, more crap than I'm afraid to spend my hard-earned dough on, lest I suffer wave after wave of buyer's remorse. Enter Hoopla, H-O-O-P-L-A, a service your local library can tie into, allowing you the opportunity to borrow items electronically. I've mentioned the app before, and I'm recommending it again for comic book reading, though it also gives users access to ebooks, audiobooks, and music, and there's quite a Western selection.
I've seen it at my library, but I've never used it.
Recently, a series of Western comics called Bouncer caught my eye. The 7-volume series follows the adventures of a 1-armed gunslinger and sometimes saloon bouncer in one of the Wild West's most dangerous and vice-infested towns. It's one of those creative works that deserves some attention, not necessarily because of what it is, but who created it. Americans may not be familiar with the artist Bocquet, who draws Bouncer in a loose, gritty style. But in France, his surreal comics are quite popular, including the adventures of Jérôme Moucherot, a door-to-door insurance salesman with a fountain pen through his nose, who is dressed in a leopard fur suit. I can't make this stuff up. This guy can. His bizarre adventures take place in a world where Smurfs are jungle-dwelling headhunters and sharks swim around in the blue wallpapers of a bourgeois living room. So that's the artist.
Yikes.
On the other hand, Western fans certainly know the writer Alexandro Jodorowsky. Director of 1970s El Topo, Jodorowsky almost single-handedly defined the subgenre acid Western, though that appellation was in the works before El Topo hit the screen. So let's back up a minute. I don't think we've talked a lot about acid Westerns on this show.
I certainly don't think so.
And maybe for a good reason. Your Six Gun Justice hosts are all about big tent Western inclusion, and acid Westerns are almost as controversial among Western fans as, well, the Alamo.
Uh-oh.
Wikipedia defines acid Westerns as metaphorical ambitions of critically acclaimed Westerns, such as Shane and the Searchers, with the excesses of the spaghetti Westerns, and the outlook of the counterculture of the 1960s. Like so many of these fringe things, I'm not sure what it is, but I think I know it when I see it. Some point to 1966 and The Shooting, directed by Monty Hellman and starring Will Hutchins, Warren Oates, and Jack Nicholson, as the first true acid Western. Other films included in the genre are Hellman's Two-Lane Blacktop and Sam Peckinpah's Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid. But in 1970, Jodorowsky released El Topo, which he both starred in and directed. It's a weird movie about a wandering Mexican bandit who is killed and resurrected inside a mountain cave. Like a lot of things from youth, I remember trying it out only once, didn't get into it very far, and I've never looked back.
It's a very weird film, and you have to be of the right frame of mind to get all the way through it. It's just odd.
Or maybe your mind needs to be on the right...
on the right drug, yeah.
Well, so now Jodorowsky is back, but with a comic book. And Jodorowsky has a string of comics credits to his name, so I gave Bouncer a second chance after the first volume left me pretty cold. If graphic violence in the spirit of the George Gilman Edge titles is your thing, you might enjoy the first volume more than I did. But be warned, it is graphic, gory stuff. Again, had I been required to pay for the opportunity to continue on with the story, I would have dropped it right there. But Hoopla is free. Jodorowsky's a name I know, so I continued on. Past the gratuitous stuff, the story is kind of compelling, involving a strange old woman who controls a criminal enterprise and an odd assortment of characters, including a guy named Axehead, who, you guessed it, has an axe embedded in his head.
Wow, I never would have figured that out.
The steel intrusion has driven him quite mad, of course, and any sudden move might prove fatal to him. You know, honestly, Paul, we ought to do a show sometime about Western oddities. Maybe we could include Courtney Joyner's wonderfully weird character, Shotgun.
Or the 8-book Leatherhand series by Mike Wales, which features a paw-challenged vigilante, and the TV series Tate has another one-handed lawman. I guess we could call the episode Walking Wounded Westerns.
And then again, maybe not. That's your cue, Paul, to tell us what you're recommending today.
I'd like to talk about a new standalone Western by one of our Six Gun Justice deputies, G. Wayne Tillman. Wayne has been both a deputy sheriff and an FBI unit chief, and his heritage includes a direct line to the legendary lawman Bill Tillman. And to top it off, his mother was a counterintelligence operative.
That's really an incredible background to come from.
Yeah, you know it. Wayne has written a number of thrillers and westerns, but the book I want to share is a western with a very different twist. Ghost Posse is one of those ideas I wish I had thought of myself. In the period from 1865 to 1882, several of the deadliest outlaws and assassins in America died of lead poisoning, or did they? Wayne uncovered some historic evidence suggesting they faked their deaths, the youngest of them not passing away until 1950. Utilizing this dubious information, Wayne sets his story in 1883 when a secret organization brings together John Wilkes Booth, Captain William Quantrill, Jesse and Frank James, and Billy the Kid to rescue the kidnapped daughter of one of their own. This gang of killers form a ghost posse, riding together down a dusty trail of their own for one last mission before returning to anonymity, if they don't kill each other first. I had to read this book because I couldn't conceive of any possible way Wayne could pull this off. But he does, brilliantly. For Western readers looking for something different, Ghost Posse is a great choice.
Fascinating idea, that is. Kudos to Wayne for pulling all those threads together.
When I spoke to him about Ghost Posse, he said it took him over a decade to figure it all out and give the story a through thread of believability. Every time he finished writing another book, he'd pick up the Ghost Posse idea again and work with it. Eventually, the book that wouldn't leave him alone found its way onto the page.
It sounds as if he was following a dusty trail of his own, which I hope is a good segue to letting loose the cattle and getting on with our feature.
If you say so. Like the 1923 silent epic, The Covered Wagon, and 1930's leading man debut of John Wayne in The Big Trail, many Western stories took their cue from the westward movement of the pioneers crossing the hazardous and danger-filled frontier. These adventures filled the pages of pulpy dime novels mostly aimed at juvenile audiences, the popular novels aimed at more adult readers, and films with which everyone was fascinated.
As I'm sure you know, The Big Trail was not only an early talkie, but it was also supposed to be young John Wayne's breakthrough to stardom, which really wouldn't happen for another 10 years when he starred in Stagecoach.
Yeah, the big problem with The Big Trail wasn't Wayne. The film failed to find a wide audience because it was also an epic experiment in what 20th Century Fox had termed grandeur, 70mm widescreen filming. Unfortunately, this new widescreen format required extensive retooling of theatrical exhibition equipment and projection rooms. And in the depths of the Great Depression of the 1930s, few exhibitors had the funds or the willingness to make those changes. Both John Wayne and widescreen filming techniques had to wait a few more years until they got their close-ups.
Wagon train stories always needed heroes to keep things moving along. As the fur trade faded, mountain men such as Kit Carson found their knowledge of wilderness trails and survival skills made them in demand as wagon train scouts. Their exploits became the inspiration for many fictional or fictionalized heroes and turned the trails they established into exciting stories.
In 1931, Gary Cooper starred in Fighting Caravans as a wagon train scout in a Zane Grey story, leading a wagon train constantly hounded by Kiowa from Independence, Missouri to Sacramento. And one thing I didn't know was that Kiowas covered all that territory, but that's another subject for another show.
Right.
3 years later, Randolph Scott would star in the Gary Cooper role in a low-budget remake of Fighting Caravans, renamed Wagon Wheels, which used extensive stock footage from the earlier film.
I never realized how much that happened until we started doing the Six Gun Justice podcast, how much old stock film was reused.
Yeah, we talked about it in last episode about the Alamo, and I think we've mentioned it before. It's a way to spread the budget out, I guess, but it really shows, I think, in the films, it's not the same as doing it new.
You can always kind of tell where they make the transition, and especially now when we have instant access to everything, very often we recognize things we just saw like 2 days before.
Right. It's like when they're filming Los Angeles and you recognize New York landmarks.
Right. In the 1940 film Kit Carson, John Hall would star as the legendary and highly fictionalized mountain man and pathfinder leading a wagon train to California during the 1840s.
The son of Mormon immigrants, James Cruz, the director of The Covered Wagon, had grown up on stories of the Mormons who trekked across the prairies and mountains on their way to Salt Lake. This historic journey, filled with danger, determination, and faith, found its way into such films as 1946's Bad Bascom, starring Wallace Beery, and 1948's Brigham Young, from director Henry Hathaway, starring Tyrone Power.
The biggest names among directors of Westerns have also done wagon train Westerns, John Ford, Anthony Mann, Howard Hawks, and others. Even though it's not as highly regarded because of its lack of star power, John Ford claimed his own favorite among the movies was 1950's Wagon Master, which also featured another story centered around pioneering Mormons.
Most of the biggest stars in Westerns also starred in one or more wagon train films. I mentioned John Wayne in The Big Trail, who would also star in the wagon train movies The Oregon Trail and Three Faces West. I also mentioned a very skinny Gary Cooper in Fighting Caravans and Randolph Scott in Wagon Wheels. But there was also James Stewart in 1952's Bend of the River and Kirk Douglas, Robert Mitchum, and Richard Widmark in 1967's The Way West, and many more.
Let's move to the Southwest and talk Santa Fe Trail. I've actually stood at the beginnings of the Santa Fe Trail in what is now the village of Arrow Rock, Missouri. It's a fascinating place that I'll talk more about next time in our Trailblazer episode due to the historic presence of Daniel Boone. For now, I'll remind our listeners that the original trail, officially finding its origin a few miles away in Franklin, Missouri, and terminating in Santa Fe, New Mexico territory, was in 1821, 900 miles of unclaimed wilderness vital to the formation of America as we know it. It gave rise to untold numbers of historical and fictional characters. On the fictional side of things, I'd like to talk about Santa Fe Passage, a 1955 true color movie based on a story by Clay Fisher in Esquire, April 1952. The short story is available online with a subscription to Esquire's backlog, and the website provides a colorful reproduction of the print magazine's provocative double-page spread by illustrator extraordinaire Walter Baumhofer. And a tip of the Stetson to Six Gun Justice deputy Bob Deese for identifying the piece. Author Clay Fisher, whose real name was Henry Wilson Allen, worked for MGM on their cartoons. Allen scripted Barney the Bear and eventually moved on to Walter Lantz's Woody Woodpecker. His first Western novel in 1950 was No Survivors. Afraid that the studio wouldn't approve of him moonlighting as a novelist, he used the pen name Clay Fisher. In the ensuing years, he wrote more than 50 novels, 8 of which were adapted to the screen, including McKenna's Gold, Yellowstone Kelly, The Tall Men, and the work we'll talk about today, Santa Fe Passage. As Heck Allen, the author has more than 82 credits at the Internet Movie Database, most for his Tex Avery and Walter Lantz cartoons, but also for Western scripts that ranged as far and wide as The Zane Grey Theater and Tales of Wells Fargo. Allen was a 5-time Spur Award winner from the Western Writers of America and a recipient of the Levi Strauss Award for Lifetime Achievement. Paul, I used to believe when it came to adaptations of books or stories, the print version was always superior to the film version. That belief has been challenged over the years, no more so than this past year working on the podcast.
I hear you. Books like Hondo or Shane are terrific, but arguably the films are what we remember for their iconic place in the Western cultural landscape. Sometimes the film transcends the source material.
Having enjoyed the novel, I came to Santa Fe Passage with high hopes, only to have them dashed. In this case, my original view of the print version being superior proved true. The story is an interesting saga for our times. The tale of an Indian-hating protagonist, Santa Fe Trail scout Kirby Randolph, coming to grips with his bigotry. No spoilers here, but Kirby's developing perspective on Native American culture is more natural and necessary in the print story. In the film, it's an abrupt, contrived thing that actor John Payne does not pull off well at all. In fact, Payne and co-star Slim Pickens, whose character's name is Sam Beekman, are so viciously racist at the beginning of the film, it's hard to have any sympathy at all when their plan to sell deliberately sabotaged rifles to the Kiowa chief goes wrong and results in the natives wiping out an entire wagon train. Because of Kirby and Sam's bungling, they're pariahs in the scouting biz. But they get a second chance with wagon train leader Jess Griswold, played by Rod Cameron, freighting guns over the Santa Fe Trail. They need to avoid the Kiowa chief and his tribe. Again, it's hard to have any compassion at all for Kirby and Sam. As you might expect from director William Whitney, who worked on a slew of 40s action serials, as well as TV's Zorro, there's plenty of action to keep things hopping, and the outdoor scenes shot in Utah's Snow Canyon State Park are beautiful.
It may be worth a look, but the print story is better, right?
Yes, indeed.
You read another book called Santa Fe Passage.
Yeah, John R. Bowman is an international lawyer and nonfiction author, and his first novel, Santa Fe Passage, from 2007, is an excellent read, telling the early 1800s story of Matthew Collins, a young entrepreneur who freights a wagon train load of goods to Mexican Santa Fe against all odds, and achieving success rises to national prominence during the Mexican-American War. It's great. With Bowman's precise historic detail and depth of character, you'll wonder how much of the story is fact and how much is fiction. It's a page-turner that deals with many of the same interracial themes as Clay Fisher's book, but here the prose is more tasteful and literary, more nuanced, and much less pulpy. Sometimes that's a good thing, and in this case, it's a wonderful thing, so highly recommended.
Sounds good.
Finally, I would be remiss as a native Nebraskan if I didn't recommend Willa Cather's great 1927 novel, Death Comes for the Archbishop. The story is about the establishment of a newly created diocese in New Mexico and is based on two historical figures, Jean-Baptiste Lamay and Joseph Projectus Machabou. At heart, it's a trail novel, but so much more as Cather works in fictional appearances by real-life characters Kit Carson, Manuel Antonio Chavez, and Pope Gregory XVI. Be sure to check it out, even if your high school teacher made you read it for freshman English.
I would never go back and read anything a teacher made me read in freshman English. Why do they do that? Why do they pick books that kids don't want to read? I mean, it makes no sense to me.
And books that are good, but maybe not good for that age group, and they ruin them for life.
Absolutely. Getting back to what we're talking about, the Oregon Trail, the Santa Fe Trail, the Chisholm Trail, the Goodnight Trail, and many other established routes became the stuff of legends. The railroad, the telegraph, Wells Fargo, the Pony Express, and so many other examples of civilization progressing towards manifest destiny all relied on dusty trails crisscrossing the frontier as part of their expansion.
A popular paperback original series to use wagon trains as a focal point is the 24-book Wagons West series by Dana Fuller Ross, a pseudonym for Noel Bertram Gerson. An astonishingly prolific writer, Gerson wrote 325 books under 10 different pseudonyms, including the first 12 books in the long-running White Indian series written as Donald Clayton Porter, among many others. The Wagons West series is a blend of Western romance and adventure. The first book, Independence, begins in 1837 with the organization of the first large wagon train of settlers. The dauntless band of pioneers sets out from Long Island on a mission to win the rich Oregon Territory for America. The major characters are fiery young widow Claudia Humphreys and bold wagon master Sam Brentwood, who commands the first leg of the remarkable journey. The series goes on to chronicle the settling of the West, tracing the lives of its large cast of characters.
Another wagon train movie, Bend of the River, from 1952, starring James Stewart and directed by Anthony Mann, is another strong film played out against a wagon train background. The tight script was written by Borden Chase, adapted from William Gulick's novel, Bend of the Snake.
You know, we talk about John Ford or maybe Bud Bedeker or some of these people, but a lot of the movies we touch on are directed by Anthony Mann.
They certainly are. I think he's an underrated director.
I do too. So Bend of the River is the film where James Stewart plays some kind of former Missouri border ruffian trying to escape his past, gets roped into leading a wagon train to Oregon against considerable odds.
Yeah, Stewart plays Glenn McClintock, and Arthur Kennedy plays opposite him as Emerson Cole, a conniving backstabber McClintock saves from being lynched. Once McClintock gets the wagon train to Oregon, where the homesteaders establish a settlement outside of Portland, the real difficulties begin. With winter on the way, McClintock realizes the community's expected stores of food and supplies are being held in Portland by corrupt officials. Enlisting Cole's help, McClintock gets the goods, but on the trip back to the settlement, upriver and over a mountain, Cole engineers a mutiny to divert the supplies to a gold mining camp for a handsome profit. James Stewart being James Stewart, or in this case, James Stewart being Glenn McClintock, he has too much sand to let this go.
2010's Meek's Cutoff is a quirky, feminist-based wagon train western, which slowly, very slowly, drags you into its spell. Loosely based on a true incident involving a wagon train of three families being misled in Oregon by feckless mountain man scout Stephen Meek, who they have hired to guide them over the Cascade Mountains. Claiming to know a shortcut, Meek leads the group on an unmarked path across the High Plain Desert, only to become disoriented in the dry rocks and sage. Stranded and lost, the wagon trainers must face the afflictions of hunger, thirst, and their own lack of faith in each other's instincts for survival. It is the women among the families who rise to the occasion, revealing the strength of the many female pioneers who proved to be as tough and often tougher than the men they traveled with.
I've seen this film as well. It's well made, but it's not a lighthearted entertainment by a long shot. What I found interesting was the severity of the situation deepens, and the film takes on this sense of gritty realism without going over the top. The wagon trainers aren't stumbling around filthy and bloody. Instead, they're making efforts to maintain some sort of human civility, even as reaching civilization again seems more and more doubtful.
And in the end, the film presents a difficult conundrum when a Native American crosses their path. With his appearance on the screen, the women find themselves torn between their trust in a guide who has proven himself unreliable and a man who has always been seen as the natural enemy.
And I have to say, I found the ambiguous ending frustrating, which is the final drawback which drops this film off my recommendation list.
Despite the strong performances and interesting direction, I have to agree with you, Paul. I just found the movie too slow and, if you've seen it, maybe too beige. With all the sand and everything, everything's not very colorful.
Very beigey.
Yeah.
On a lighter note, trailblazing cattle drives also provided a lot of grist for the story mill. Starting with The Goodnight Trail, the prolific Ralph Compton made his name with a series of solid westerns titled after the many established cattle drive tales. Compton wrote more than 20 cattle drive-centered stories among his many other westerns, and there have been another 15 or 16 written by authors now writing for the Ralph Compton brand. By romanticizing the experience, hardships, and skills involved in moving cattle from one place to another, the cattle drive becomes a perfect background for the adventurous characters to deal with nasty weather, floods, Indians, outlaws, stampedes, lack of water, snakes, and anything else creative writers could throw at them.
The standard cattle drive story moves north from Texas to Dodge City, Abilene, or even as far as Montana. But cattle drives have also been set in unusual locations, such as the Canadian Caribou Trail, Alaska, and Australia.
Or, as we've talked about so many times on the podcast, the Siberian Wilderness in Claire Huffaker's The Cowboy and the Cossack.
What a great book that is. The cattle drive is also a good vehicle for other stories, such as the coming-of-age tales featured in the Culpeper Cattle Company or the Cowboys.
And sometimes, as in The Man from Snowy River and Broken Trail, cows are replaced by horses. But nevertheless, cattle drives have been featured in some of the greatest westerns, both cinematically and on the page.
I'm a big fan of Red River from 1948, which starts out as a wagon train movie and ends up as a cattle drive movie. John Wayne plays the tyrannical Thomas Dunson, who loses the woman he loves after he leaves a wagon train that later is attacked by Comanches. Years later, Wayne has established his Red River Ranch and is determined to get his herd to market at any cost, even if it means killing his adopted son, played by Montgomery Clift, a survivor of the original Indian wagon train attack. As the cattle drive moves along, it encounters Indian attacks, gunfights, stampedes. But aside from the action, director Howard Hawks' frontier vistas make Red River a great Western. However, it is the deft portrayals of complicated characters with challenging relationships that make Red River a truly great movie.
Another top John Wayne entry into the cattle drive sweepstakes is The Cowboys from 1972. Wayne plays rancher Will Anderson. After his crew abandons him for the gold fields, Anderson's only chance of driving his herd to market is to take on an inexperienced band of young boys. This is clearly a coming-of-age movie, as Anderson teaches the motley crew of youngsters what it means to do a man's job, including dealing with the cattle thieves trailing them.
I personally think this is one of John Wayne's best late-career westerns. The script is tight and at times surprisingly delightful, and the cinematography is stunning. Paul, this is one of two movies, the other which we've recently talked about, where John Wayne is killed. Do you know what the other one was?
Yes, The Alamo.
And so I'll say that while I really like the Cowboys, I don't like that aspect of it. I wish Wayne's character could have been saved.
And we should have put a spoiler alert in front of this. So everybody, if you've never seen this and now the movie's spoiled for you, don't send me the hate mail. Send it to Rich.
And don't read about it on Wikipedia. You'll find out the answer to the trivia question I just gave you.
I still think that despite everything else, The Cowboys is a must-see.
Often overlooked, 1972's The Culpeper Cattle Company features the adventures of tenderfoot Ben Mockridge, a teenage farm boy who longs to be a cowhand after he talks tough trail boss Frank Culpeper into hiring him on for a cattle drive. What follows is an unflinching portrait of how bleak life could be in the West. Instead of the exciting, heroic, macho life Ben envisioned, being a cowhand turns out to be endless hard work, dumb chores, and embarrassment, even getting literally caught with his pants down, robbed of his horse, and witnessing unpunished crimes. The film is gritty, violent, and rough, with blurry boundaries between the white hats and the bad hats.
There are no big names in the credits, but for me, The Culpeper Cattle Company is an excellent Western that dives deep into the moral ambiguity of the frontier. It's not until the end of the film that the four main characters are pressed to finally take a moral stand to redeem themselves with a final act of personal responsibility. It really is an overlooked gem.
You've told me in the past how much you enjoyed the more modern-day cattle drive movie, 1991's City Slickers, because it paralleled one of your own experiences.
City Slickers is even more of a hoot if you've actually been there, done that. In the film, Billy Crystal and his friends are having a midlife crisis. They decide the best antidote is to go on a Wild West cattle drive adventure under the guidance of the cantankerous and threatening Outfit Ramrod, played by Jack Palance. Outlandish hijinks and mishaps ensue, which make the film a rarity, a Western comedy that manages to be hilarious, thoughtful, and inspiring.
And your own experience.
Similar in many ways, in 1988, so a couple of years before the film came about, a buddy and I, both tenderfoots, joined an experienced outfit of wranglers in Northern California to drive a pack of 200 wild horses from their winter to summer feeding grounds. I won't say it was as hilarious as City Slickers, but there was enough hijinks and crazy things that happened to make it an experience I'll never forget.
So you earned your spurs.
I certainly did. And speaking of earning your spurs...
That's a terrible segue.
But we're going to go with it. In a prior episode, we talked at length about the TV series Wagon Train and Rawhide, representing respectively the longest wagon train journey of all time and the dustiest string of cattle drives on the small screen. But in reality, the miniseries based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning Lonesome Dove is the big dog of the small screen.
Lonesome Dove is the beloved Western epic that follows the Hat Creek outfit led by ex-Texas Rangers Woodrow Call and Augustus McCrae on one last great adventure driving cattle from Texas to Montana. The story of friendship, values, and a fading way of life was a favorite with audiences and critics. The series won 7 Emmys and breathed new life into the Western genre at the time.
Maybe so, but I have to tell you, I've struggled through numerous attempts to read the book, I've tried to listen to the book on audio, and I've tried several times to watch the miniseries. Somehow, I just can't make it to the end.
Now you're going to have to turn in those spurs.
I know. Everybody raves about Lonesome Dove, many cite it as their favorite Western. I know I'm a very tiny minority, but for me, Lonesome Dove is a case of the emperor has no clothes. There's an excellent Western somewhere in all those pages, but it's surrounded by so much superfluous stuff, dare I say padding, that it gets lost.
It's really that superfluous stuff that makes Lonesome Dove so special. Without it, it is just another cattle drive Western.
I do get your point objectively, but I just don't get it on the emotional level that so many people do.
For me, it's an ambitious epic that couldn't have been better cast. Tommy Lee Jones and Robert Duvall disappear into their roles as two cantankerous retired Texas Rangers looking for one last adventure.
I'll grant you the casting is brilliant, but there were a lot of bumps along the way before the lightning in a bottle of Jones and Duvall struck.
Just like the scene in the book and the miniseries with the cattle getting electrocuted by lightning, that's actually a real phenomenon, by the way, called St. Elmo's Fire. Cattle getting struck by lightning, passing the fatal charge into one another through their horns.
Whoa, that has to be scary to witness.
And sometimes if you're just riding through the cattle, you can see the electrical sparks along their horns, and it doesn't hurt them sometimes.
Sometimes. It's the other times you got to worry about.
No kidding. Lonesome Dove started life as a much shorter screenplay called Streets of Laredo. It was written 15 years earlier by Larry McMurtry and Peter Bogdanovich and was supposed to star John Wayne as Call, Jimmy Stewart as Gus, and Henry Fonda as Jake Spoon. But Wayne dropped out and that killed the project. The Streets of Laredo screenplay sat on the shelf for about 15 years until one day McMurtry saw an old bus with Lonesome Dove Baptist Church inscribed on the side. He went home and finished the story as a novel, taking his inspiration from the lives of Charles Goodnight and Oliver Loving, who blazed the Goodnight Trail across terrain thought impassable.
I read somewhere that McMurtry wrote Lonesome Dove to change the romantic notions people have about the cowboy life and cattle drives. He wanted to show the brutal hardships and difficult times cowboys faced on the frontier.
If that's true, then I think he failed miserably. After the book came out, everybody in Texas, given half a chance, would have been willing to trade in their suits and office jobs to get on a horse and drive cattle to Montana with Woodrow and Gus. Response to the novel was so strong, it went on to win the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction in 1986, which led to the movie rights being bought by Motown.
Which seems a very strange bedfellow.
It does, but Motown producers Suzanne DePass and Bill Whitliff delivered what many consider a masterpiece.
Even after the miniseries was on track, there were some interesting casting changes. Duvall was originally signed for the role of Woodrow Call. However, after reading the script, he insisted on playing Gus McCrae. With the role of Call open again, it was offered to Charles Bronson, but he declined due to contractual obligations. Then James Garner was cast, but had to drop out for health reasons, which left the way clear for Tommy Lee Jones to finally get the nod.
Whatever the route they took to get there, Duvall and Jones own the roles. They're perfect as heroic archetypes, but the story questions their motivations and the worth of what they're doing. For me, that's the balance that makes Lonesome Dove a masterpiece.
And I'm saved by the bell. Or in this case, the clanging of the chuck wagon triangle, telling us to wrap this episode up with our shootouts and shoutouts.
Thanks to Mike Bray and Wolfpack Publishing for being our premier sponsor. Thanks also to our other sponsors, author Chris Enns and the Western Writers of America. Thanks to Roundup Magazine for their support in promoting our podcast.
Thanks to our crew of Patreon backers for their financial support. If you're enjoying the podcast, please check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/sixgunjustice and consider giving a small monthly stipend to help us keep moseying along. Donations are appreciated, but clearly not expected or necessary. We're grateful for all our listeners and truly happy to have you sharing this trail ride with us.
Next Monday, Paul will be hosting a Six Gun Justice Speed Listen featuring everything you need to know about vintage women who wrote the West, all in under 15 minutes, give or take.
Well, actually, it's going to be all in under 30 minutes, give or take, but you get the gist of what we're trying to say. And in 2 weeks, we'll be back with episode 32 of the Six Gun Justice podcast.
And don't forget our Six Gun Justice conversation segments every Wednesday, when either Paul or I get to hang around the Six Gun Justice Corral, talking with writers and friends who love the Western genre as much as we do.
Until we meet again, be kind to each other. Be kind to yourselves, and may all your trails be happy.
Adios for now.
We're out of here. Let's ride.
Join us in 2 weeks for another full-length episode of the Six Gun Justice Podcast, sponsored by author Chris Enns, the Western Writers of America, and Wolfpack Publishing. publishers of such best-selling Western series as The Legend of the Black Rose and Concho.